What is the purpose of life? Does it have any meaning? What is of most value? Those are questions that Ecclesiastes is going to help us to answer. Ecclesiastes as a whole is going to help us to live life in the real world. But Ecclesiastes is also going to hit us hard, and it is going to stop us from trying to play let's pretend. Let's pretend everything's all right. Let's pretend that's not real. Let's pretend that we can avoid that. And it's going to tell us that if we want to live life well, if we want to live life well, we need to be ready to die. We need to be prepared to die. We need to live with the reality of death right in front of our faces. That's what Ecclesiastes is going to tell us. In the words of one commentator, Ecclesiastes teaches us to live life backwards. In other words, you've got to be ready to die to truly live. You've got to be prepared for death. Death has got to be a reality in your thinking so that you can live right and true. And so in many senses, Ecclesiastes is a very apt thing to think about now at the beginning of 2021, because 2020 was a year where the reality of death was everywhere. It was all over the media. First thing you could wake up to on a morning as you flicked on your BBC app on your phone or turned the TV on and stuck the news on was the death count from the previous day. And this year will start pretty much the same. Death is reality and it is everywhere. But that means Ecclesiastes is not going to be an easy ride. Some of what we read in Ecclesiastes will still be quite shocking. I think it'll shake the comfortable foundations that many of us have. It will expose our hearts and it will burst some of our bubbles. But it will be good for our souls. Why? Because it's the Word of God. It's not a part of the Word of God that we should be ashamed of and shove under the carpet somewhere. It's a part of the Word of God we should read and enjoy and learn from and be challenged by. And because it's the Word of God, His Spirit can take that Word and bring transformation in us, bring healing in us, bring restoration in us. Think about it this way. A surgeon uses a knife to cut people open, but it's painful. Yeah, I know, we've got lots of great anaesthetics and things, and you probably don't feel the incisions, but, you know, afterwards, when that wears off, there'll be a remnant of pain there at least. And the wound that the surgeon inflicts takes time to heal, but it's far better that the surgeon takes that scalpel, cuts us open and removes the bowel obstruction or the tumour or the artery block than it be left. It's far better that the surgeon does that. And the Word of God in the hands of the Spirit of God is like a surgeon's knife. Now, if you want to read up on the author of the book, we're not going to do a lot of background now. If you want to read up on the author of the book and its title and what it means and all the kind of stuff that people have written about it, great, go for it. Be my guest. But don't get bogged down in it, because there's just pages and pages written about it. For our study, we are going to call the author the preacher or the teacher, as is in the NIV verse 1, the words of the teacher or the preacher. And we are simply going to say that he is a son of David, who may or may not be Solomon. He sounds a lot like Solomon in terms of the wisdom that he speaks about, in terms of the possessions he says that he has. But he also seems to be writing at a time that is way, way later than Solomon lived. So he's either somebody writing as though he's Solomon, or somehow Solomon writing with a very different mindset in context. So we're going to say that it's the preacher, and we're going to say that he is a son of David, whoever he may be. And the book opens with an unbelievably bold and brutal and emphatic statement, doesn't it? A statement that hits us square between the eyes. Meaningless, meaningless, says the teacher. Utterly meaningless, everything is meaningless. Or vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Really? Really, preacher? Everything is vanity. Everything is totally and utterly vanity or meaningless. Now, the word that is translated there And forgive me for having to do a little bit of Hebrew with you this morning. We have to do this because this word is key to the entire book. The word that is translated meaningless in the NIV or vanity in the King James and the ESV is more literally vapor. Breath. That's what the word means. If you listen to Psalm 39, verses 5 to 6 and verse 11, you'll hear it three times, and it's not there as meaningless, but as breath or vain. You've made my days a mere handbreadth. The span of my years is as nothing before you. Everyone is but a breath, even those who seem secure. Surely everyone goes around like a mere phantom. They rush about, heaping up wealth without knowing whose it will finally be. When you rebuke and discipline anyone for their sin, you consume their wealth like a moth. Surely everyone is but a breath. Our understanding of this word hebel, and that's not how you pronounce it in Hebrew, but I can't pronounce Hebrew, so we're saying hebel because that's how I'm going to pronounce it. That word means breath or vapor, and it appears 38 times in the book of Ecclesiastes. The idea that the preacher is wanting to give us right at the very beginning is that everything is short-lived. Everything is here 1 minute and gone the next. Now, I know you're all wearing masks, but indulge me on this. Take a deep breath in and out. That's it. That's life. That's what the preacher says. Everything is vapor. Everything is vanity. Everything is breath. Done. That's it. Gone. Now, the preacher doesn't tell you why he thinks that's the case yet. He just wants to open with, this is it. Everything is breath. He's going to explain throughout the rest of Ecclesiastes why that's the conclusion he's come to. But he just wants to hit you between the eyes to start with by telling you that everything is vapor. In other words, life is like a puff of smoke. It's temporary. It is fleeting. It can't be taken hold of and it cannot be held onto. Now, the modern thing is to vape rather than smoke, isn't it? Have you walked behind anybody who's vaping before? Big cloud comes up, almost engulfing the person who's vaping. If you're close enough behind them and you breathe in, you will get an intense hit of whatever flavour they happen to be vaping on. Now, to be fair, some of them are quite nice. I walked behind somebody who must have been vaping something like strawberries and cream. And to be fair, it was a very nice smell. Not like getting a face full of cigarette smoke. But within a second or two, it's gone, isn't it? It's disappeared, evaporated. If I thought, wow, that flavour's amazing, I want to keep it in my pocket for later, and went like this, what would happen when I opened my hand? Well, it's not going to be there, is it? It's gone. It's disappeared into the air. It's evaporated. If I try and grab it and breathe more of it in, I'm just going to look like an idiot, and I'm going to fail miserably. That vapour, that smoke, doesn't have any lasting impact in the grand scheme of things. Yes, it's not healthy for the person breathing it in, but the puff of smoke that you see isn't remembered, is it? It's gone. It doesn't change the world. It is fleeting. And that's what the preacher says life is like. A puff of smoke, and it's gone. Another day, another week, another year, another birthday, blink, and all of a sudden you're collecting your pension. But we don't live our lives, do we, like they could end tomorrow. We don't live like life is vapor. We think life is concrete. It'll keep going. It's got a solid foundation. If you ever try to smash up concrete, it's hard to get rid of it. Doesn't disappear like vapor. It would be nice if it did. We often don't have the perspective that our lives will be over before they know it. Maybe that's because we think, well, look, I'm fit and healthy and I'm nowhere near 70 years old yet. Maybe it's because we think, well, I haven't had my recognition yet and I know I'm meant for something more than this. I'm meant for a major contribution to the society and the world hasn't seen the best of me yet. I must have loads of time left. Maybe it's because We think, actually, I'm involved in some really important ministries in the church. Surely I am a key part of God's mission to the world. He needs me. The reality is, even if we live to 100, even if we outlast the 70 years that probably is the world average, I don't know off the top of my head, or the 84 years that is kind of the British average to live, even if we get to 100 and we get our letter from the Queen, although it'll not be the Queen by the time most of us get to 100, it'll be the King. If we ever reach that milestone, life will still have been short. It will still have been breath, vapor, gone. In the grand scheme of history, it's not going to be remembered. Preacher says, life is short. Verse 3 introduces us to then another word and another phrase that are really important to get our heads round to understand the whole of the book. Those two things are gain and under the sun. Gain is the idea of having something left over, something of a profit, some kind of benefit at the end. It doesn't have to be financial gain, but that's the language that it's using. It's the idea of something that is left over, a profit. And the question of what gain is there is repeated. And preacher's saying, look, if everything is temporary, if everything is quickly fading away, if life is messy and complicated, then what's the point? Is there any value in it? Is there any gain in it? Is there any worth in it? That's the question. What do people gain from all their labours at which they toil under the sun? And that idea of under the sun, again, is a repeated phrase throughout the book, 30 times or more. And it's the idea of life lived in this world. This world that is made by God, that was all good when he made it, but now is broken and messed up and frustrating. A world that is full of sin and evil and injustice. Now, I don't believe that when the preacher speaks about life under the sun, that he is just referring to people who live life without reference to God. I don't think that's what he means. I think he's talking about the general human experience of day-to-day life. Life lived under the sun, just life lived on this planet by anyone and everyone. And so verse 3 is asking this question, what is the outcome of all the effort and hard work that human beings put into the business of living? What's the outcome of it? What's the gain? Is there a profit at the end of that? Again, he doesn't answer the question straight away. He's made this massive statement in verse 2 and left it hanging. Now he's asked this huge question in verse 3 and he also leaves it hanging. But that's also because that's what wisdom literature is like in the Bible. And we don't really have, I can't think of modern day wisdom literature like this. The idea is that the writer writes something and you're supposed to read it and then you're supposed to stop and think about it. You're supposed to wrestle with it. You're supposed to grapple with it. You're supposed to struggle with it. You're supposed to read it and think, hold on a minute, is that really what he's saying? And then get into it. And so the preacher asks these questions, makes these bold statements, and then he follows it with a bunch of things to help you think about it. In this case, they are from verses 4 to 11. But let's first of all look at verses 4 to 7. After raising the huge statement and the question, he then points us towards nature. And he teaches us that life is not just short, life is not just like a puff of smoke, but life is also really repetitive. Nature, he says, is full of circular movements. The sun rises and the sun sets. Generations come and generations go. The wind blows to the north and the south. The streams flow into the sea and yet it's never full. It's the circle of life, as Disney's Lion King tells us in the opening credits. It's the circle of life. Sun rises, sun sets, wind goes round and round, water falls, evaporates, goes back into the sky. Remember that in GCSE? Water cycle? People having like nightmares with their GCSEs coming back to them. Look again at verse 7. All the streams flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. Sound familiar? It's written on the bridge. Opposite Stockton Baptist Church. If you've not noticed it before, go down and have a look. Ecclesiastes 1 verse 7. Picture of verses 4 to 7 is up and down, in and out, round and round, endless cycles. Creation endlessly does its job. It gets on with its God's given task. Nothing really changes. And we know that repetition, don't we? We get up, We get showered, we get dressed, we eat breakfast, we go to work, we come home, we do jobs, we eat tea, we chill out, we go to bed. And what happens the next day? The same thing. There might be a slight variation on the theme, but that's basically it, isn't it? And yet, unlike the nature around us, we fight against that. We want to break free from that. Have you ever seen The Truman Show? It came out late 1990s, maybe. It's got Jim Carrey's the main character in it, and he's basically brought up in a bubble. So if you've not seen it, I am going to spoil the film for you. So you plug your ears for a minute if you really want to, but I can't not spoil the film for you. I'll try not to ruin the whole thing. But he's brought up in a bubble. Literally, he's brought up in a reality TV show bubble. His whole world is a reality TV show, but he doesn't know it. His whole life has been engineered for him. It's all fake. Everybody in his life is an actor or actress. And one of the famous lines from it that is repeated is his greeting to his neighbours as he walks out his front door. "Good morning," he says. "And in case I don't see you, good afternoon, good evening, and good night." In the end, Truman begins to figure out that something is strange about the world around him because he happens to see outside of his house the same cars going round the block. Quite long time apart, but he looks and thinks, I saw that car not long ago. Why is this repeated? And he wonders whether somebody's spying on him, and all kinds of things happen. Now, in the end, the audience of the reality TV show and everybody watching the film on their own screens at home is rooting for Truman to break free from the bubble. Everybody wants Truman to get out into the real world. It shows us, amongst other things, that we all have a deep longing for something else. Something outside, something more than the routine. We don't want to just feel like we're on the treadmill going nowhere. Do we ever find ourselves longing for something new? Something exciting, something out of the ordinary. We have a daydream about living somebody else's life instead of our own. We feel what the preacher says, don't we? That we struggle but seem to gain nothing. We work and nothing changes. We try and we try and we try. And yet what we aim for still seems to be way outside of our grasp. And verse 8 might be better translated that all things are hard at work, as in the creation is hard at work just doing its job, rather than full of weariness that I think it has in some translations. All things are wearisome. It doesn't hugely matter, because the rest of verse 8 tells us this, that people speak about, look at, and hear it all. All that happens around them in the creative world, but they can never fully get their heads around it. Partly because we don't have the time, partly because it was here long before us and it will continue to go on long after us. We enter the world, we have our X amount of years, and we leave it, and nothing much changes. But not only that, it also tells us that we never have our fill. We never reach the point of full satisfaction with what we consume. We can always see and hear and say more. You say, yeah, Matt, you can always say more, but you've said enough. There's nothing new. And then he says, there's nothing new under the sun, verse 9. It's not saying there are no new inventions, right? It is saying that those things, however good they might be, however innovative they might be, however cool they might be, they never break that cycle. Because those new things, however new they might seem, never truly satisfy. As I was preparing this, I thought, I've got a perfect example here. I just had to double check with him that I was allowed to use it. But my brother-in-law is often pointing out ideas that he has had that are now big businesses, right? So have you seen the adverts for those Ring doorbells? You know, like they've revolutionized your doorbell. I mean, that advert, Nancy, every time we watch it, Nancy says, that's really bad parenting, that is. The lady who's watching from our workspace, our kids coming home and like, oh yeah, hi kids, just get on with whatever you're doing. Like you can parent through a video camera. Anyway, that's besides the point. But that idea of who's at the door, he swears that he had the idea for a death bell long before that. He said, I've had this idea for a death bell for years, a one that flashes and lights up so that people who can't hear a doorbell can see it instead. He claims he had that idea long before any of these other fancy doorbells came about. But he didn't. Well, maybe he did, but he didn't patent it or anything like that. He also lays claim to the following things, right? Now, you might think this would be pretty cool. I don't think he's patented these either. A see-through toaster. So that you don't burn your toast. You know, when you've got those daft settings on the side, you think, oh, I'll turn it up slightly. I'd like it a bit darker this morning. It comes out, it's black. Turn it back down again. What happens? It's just bread. You can't win. He says, if you had a see-through toaster, problem solved. Clippable coasters. Something you can clip on the edge of your table so the coaster doesn't slip off, slide off, flop off when you stand your glass too close to the edge. There you go. Anybody want to go away with those ideas? Great, you can have them. As good as useful as any of those things might be, again, they aren't really going to satisfy us, are they? They'd be handy, but are they going to change your life forever? No, not really. Think about the endless advancement of technology. That's probably the biggest thing that has changed in the last generation, right? Or one of them. You think, right, I'm going to buy the new iPhone because it's going to change the world, or at least it's going to change my life. But the reality is, the moment that you buy it, in fact, probably even before you buy it, it's out of date. Why? Because there'll be a new one in 12 months' time, and the technology for that model, and probably the one after that, is already in existence. Apple aren't going to give you everything they've got immediately, because they have to stay ahead of the curve. And it's not just Apple. Replace with your favourite phone manufacturer. The minute you buy it, it's out of date. Humanity landed on the moon. One small step for man, one giant leap for mankind and all that. Has that satisfied? No, because the next thing they want to do is colonise Mars. We want to and if we colonise Mars, they'll say, great, but the next step will be, let's colonise the rest of the galaxy. And then it'll be, let's travel to a new galaxy. And never ending. Again, as one commentator puts it, remember the preacher's aim here. He is showing that at the end of the day, human beings gain nothing from their toil under the sun. There is no surplus because they are never full enough to have anything left over. We know that, don't we? And we feel that lack of contentment, that lack of fulfillment, or that lack of gain that the preacher speaks about. We agree with the Rolling Stones. I can't get no satisfaction. And I try and I try and I try and I try, but I can't get no. And then the absolute clincher comes in verse 11. This is the bombshell at the bottom of it. This is his opening salvo. He said, big question, big statement, and then the bomb drops in verse 11. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after. In other words, by the end of verse 11, the preacher is saying, we all live, we all die, we're all forgotten. It's brutal, isn't it? We all live, we all die, we're all forgotten. But he says, that's the reality. This is life, he says. Now the preacher, as he goes through, is going to point us to something beyond ourselves. He's going to point us to something beyond life under the sun. But life under the sun is life for all of us, Christian or not. We all experience the monotony. We all experience the repetition. We all experience the brevity. We all live. We all die. We're all forgotten. Now, as Christians, the major difference should be that we don't pretend that that isn't true. We don't pretend that that isn't the reality. We acknowledge that that is the reality. We acknowledge that that is true, that is life, this side of eternity. So do you see how, as a Christian, having the right perspective on life is going to come from having a clear view of death? If we know that we will die, and we know that that day is coming quickly because life is short, we will have a better perspective on life. If we know that nothing lasts forever, which was Nancy's mantra throughout pregnancy and childbirth, nothing lasts forever, then we won't try and keep hold of things that can't be held. And we won't chase after things that can't be caught, and we won't live for things that don't satisfy. With that perspective, we won't fall into the trap of thinking that something new or something different will fix our problems, which we quite often do as human beings, don't we? A new car will make travelling to work less of a frustration. A new relationship, getting married instead of being single, getting divorced instead of being married, that will give me the satisfaction or the freedom that I need. A new job will give us the money we need to be comfortable. A new place will help us escape. It will escape the people and the situations that are bringing us down. We will have the freedom to be who we want to be if we live somewhere else. We might even just be looking at something smaller. A new week. Next week, my to-do list will be shorter. Again, the commentator David Gibson says this: we long for change in a world of repetition, and we dream of how we can interrupt it. We long for lives of permanence in a world that is constantly changing, and we are trying to achieve it. We spend our lives aligning our better selves with a different future that we envisage is more rewarding. And in it all, we are simply trying to make permanent what is not meant to be permanent. That's us. And by constant change, we're trying to control what is not meant to be controlled, which is the world around us. The seasons and natural cycles of the world are content to come and go, but we sweat and toil to make believe that it will not be so with us. See, from the shelves that are full of anti-aging creams to the extremes of being cryogenically frozen, we're trying to stay young and live forever. Halting change or delaying the inevitable, trying to control something that we cannot control. From holidays under the sun, to new houses, to new cars, to keeping up with the latest technology, to changing jobs, to taking up new hobbies, we're all trying to change a life that seems to be heading nowhere fast. Isn't what the preacher gets at here at least partly behind marital affairs and midlife crises and so on? We sit up and think there's got to be something more, there's got to be something better. We think we should have achieved or experienced much more than we have by the age that we are. How much time and energy do we spend fighting to change what we can't change and keeping hold of things that we can't keep hold of? And that root, isn't that ultimately because we're trying to be God instead of living as his creatures? The preacher wants us to face the facts. Life is short, life is repetitive, we will all die, and we will all be forgotten. We all get too wrapped up in our own self-importance and our own achievements and our own goals. We all like to think that we are more significant than we are. We all like to make our mark, a lasting impression, and to leave a legacy. But if that's what we live for, then we will be disappointed. Now, if this whole thing just depresses us, then maybe we are not ready to accept the truths that the preacher wants to tell us. But if we hear those things and think, you know what, he's right. The preacher's right. And there's not much I can do about it. Then what comes next will help you to live well. Ultimately, the preacher is going to point us to Jesus. But to start off, he just wants to hit us smack in the face with reality. If that reality is painful and leaves us feeling hopeless, we need to come back to the preacher's wisdom week by week. We need to work our way through the rest of the book. Don't close Ecclesiastes and think, I never want to look at it again. Come back to it. Follow it through. See where it leads. If you know and feel the reality that the preacher has spoken about this morning, you think, well, yeah, but where do I go, Matt? The answer is, run to Jesus. He's the answer to sin and death. He's the answer to eternity. He's the one who we need now. And he is the one who will hold on to us when we have nothing else to hold on to. When everything else fades away, when everything else fails, he won't. And if you're a Christian in particular, listen to a guy with, this is a brilliant name, a guy called Nicholas Ludwig von Zinzendorf. I haven't made that up, that's really his name. Listen to what he says. He understood the reality of Ecclesiastes 1 and said this. This was his aim in life as a Christian. Preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. That's it. Preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. That should be my aim as a pastor. That should be all I'm aiming for. Shouldn't be aiming for Hardwick Baptist Church to be on the map of world churches. I shouldn't be aiming to be a famous YouTube preacher. I shouldn't be aiming for the place to be bulging at the seams so that we have to have six services to fit everybody in. I shouldn't be aiming for anything like that. I shouldn't be aiming to be liked by you guys or anything else. My aim as a preacher, and ultimately the aim of every Christian, should be that. Preach the gospel, die, be forgotten. Don't live to make a name for yourself. Live to make a name for Jesus. Live for him. Live for his praise. Live to make him known.